Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to a special bonus episode of the Paul Ryder Tapes. This episode features an extended interview with Mondays drummer Gaz Whelan, who was one of Paul's very best friends.
Oh, hang on, I need to put it so that the person speaking is full screen. How do I do that? View.
old people, eh?
Here we go. That's it. I can see your full screen now. I'm going to make it bigger. So I can't remember how much I've told you about this.
Not much, really.
All right. Okay. So basically, at the beginning of the year, we talked about it more than a year ago, but basically I was doing this podcast about online dating and I played the first episode to Paul because he's I talk about him in it, obviously. And he thought it was really good. He's like, oh, really? Oh, yeah. And I said, well, why don't we do a podcast? And because, you know, he kept going on about writing a book and I knew that it would never get finished. So we started in January and he was really into it. Like he'd come over religiously every Sunday. And we'd talk and recorded it. I can't explain it really, but there was on both our sides, there was this urgency to get it done before he went to England. Got to get it done. Got to get it finished. Got to get that podcast finished. Like, we could have finished it any time, but he kept coming. And he lives 2.5 hours drive away. Like, it was a mission to drive over here and do these recording sessions. And sometimes he couldn't do more than half an hour because it really took it out of him. You know, it was like, he said it was like therapy. Anyway, we finally finished it 12 days before he died. Like, how insane is that? And it's really weird because when I got the call, the first thing I said to Amelia was, I knew it. It's like, I knew.
I had a feeling that night. I went to bed and said to my mum, just phone Linda, say, oh, Paulie, because I've got a bad feeling about this. This was midnight. And then she got back. She said, oh, Linda said she checked on him, he's snoring. So he's still alive at midnight. And I was like, all right, okay. But I just didn't have a good feeling. And then when they phoned me in the morning, I was like, I know. I wasn't surprised.
Yeah. Yeah. And then what we'd planned to do was once we'd finished recording everything, which we'd done, we were going to have people like you and he was going to talk to you. We were going to like include people that he talks about. So now, I mean, doing it, but he's not going to be here. But I can look of everybody that he talks about, you probably pop up the most in terms of references and, oh, Gaz said this, oh, Gaz said that. So I've done like a list of like things that he talks about and it'd just be nice to get your take on those things too. Like some of them are funny stuff and some of them is the darker stuff. But like all of it, there's nothing that he's hiding or trying to bury under the carpet. And I think he just really wanted to like spill it all out. It was like really cathartic in a way.
Let's start with the darker stuff because then it's easier.
Well, you tell me when things started to go wrong, like what the first sign of everything going bad was.
What, with the band?
No, with Paul. With Paul. Yeah.
I think, for me, what I noticed was probably the Alison thing, the Alison affair when she broke up with Alison. And we were in rehearsals once in Cheetah Mill. And I went in and he was just doing heroin. And I just went, what are you doing? And as soon as he said, and he went, I know. As soon as he did that, I remember walking out. And that was, I can't remember when that was. I remember thinking, this is the beginning of the end. I remember that distinctly. He was in the kitchen, the rehearsal room in Cheetah Mill.
So he wasn't hiding it. He was doing it in front of everybody.
Well, he kind of went into the back room, but he wasn't hiding it. You could walk into the back room. He was just there. You know, he wasn't like, you know, he wasn't hiding it. No, that was the first time I'd ever saw him do it.
Yeah. And what did it make you feel?
I just knew it was it. I just knew. I thought, oh, that's it. Because I knew. Because Paul's like me in that kind of way. And I love downers. Being a stress and anxiety like Paul was, and I thought, oh, that's it. He's not coming back from that. And I thought, that's the end of the band, because he was always a driving force in the band. And once he was doing that, you know what I mean? And then, and also, from a selfish point of view, I had no ally anymore, you know?
Right. And you felt like you needed an ally?
Well, I always had an ally. We always were. It was just like me and Paul also. I was like, I didn't say anything.
Yeah.
And with Sean doing that, we kind of held it together. And as soon as he did that, I thought, well, we're screwed.
Were you angry with Sean? Because that's obviously where he got it from in the first place.
Yeah, I was at first, actually. And then afterwards, I was angry at Paul. But I was angry at well, I don't know if he got it from him, but I presumed, you know. So, yeah, that was my initial reaction was, yeah, that's true, yeah.
Okay. And then he talks in a lot of detail about his breakdown and going into Meadowbrook. And he said that you visited him every day. You were like the one person that really stuck by him through that. What was that like?
Well, I'd just had a breakdown after I'd come back from Ghana. I was halfway through a joint, and the next thing I was in the fish pond in my boxer shorts, and it was hailstoning. And the doctor said he wanted to section me, but my mum and me talked him out of it. Turned out it was the malaria tablets I'd taken, these Larian that got banned later.
Wow.
But it took me a while, and I was bad for a few months. And then Paul got sectioned, as I was like, just coming out of it. So it's kind of a bit of therapy for myself as well. But I used to go every day and see him. It was just really funny because he used to sit there in a room full of smoke. So he loved it because he was smoking. But he used to tell me about all the different characters and who they thought they were and all that. And we used to have a good laugh. He used to stay for a couple of hours. And it was kind of cathartic for me as well.
Yeah. Did you feel like he was going to get better, or were you worried he wouldn't come out of it?
I was worried he wouldn't come out of it. Yeah, because you don't know mental health, do you? And I didn't know then. You know, we were younger, still in our 20s. I didn't think he was going to have it.
So what? How was he behaving? What was the behaviour like that was weird?
He wasn't that weird. He just looked... He wasn't... In himself, when we got talking to him, he was fine. He was himself, but he was shaking a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And he seemed like... He just seemed really scared. It looked like he had shell shock. He was really scared. It was like he was in a trench and he didn't want to go over the top. Honestly, he just seemed really scared all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Really, really anxious every day, and that didn't seem to get much better.
And what did he look like?
Do you know what? It's weird because what did he look like? He had days where he looked like he was in a psychiatric ward. You know, his beard had grown out, smoking. His eyes weren't there. The textbook symptoms. But then we got talking about stuff. The thing about him is, as you know, amazing memory for things, remembers all sorts of things. And when you go back in the past and his kind of eyes lit up, so he remembers everything, really strange thing. Like you'd say it's something, just something benign, and off the cuff something for in 1983. And you know, when you said that, and you're like, what? You remember things like that, which is really bizarre.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's like he kind of always, you know what? I got the impression, and it kind of hurt him more than me. And it was a bit with me, but I hurt him more, I could tell, that it was... We knew we'd lost something that we had special as a band, and we was kind of looking back at the good times and kind of reliving them like an old rocker. And I could see that. I could see it really, really ripped him from the inside. I'd kind of had me, but, you know, he took it a lot harder. It was his band.
Yeah. Tell me a bit about the Mundyhead thing, because he said that everyone called him Mundyhead.
There was a thing in the Beatles where they used to say, where they're talking, the Beatles, and it's John Lennon and Ringo, they're going on about McCartney. In every band, there's always someone who's obsessive and drives a band, and you need them. Everyone else in the band, they hate because they do that anyway, but you need them or you'd never get anything done. Yeah. And they're talking about it, and Ringo was saying, yeah, we'd be sat in the garden in the summer in Surrey, and the phone would go, and we'd both look at each other and go, same minute, it's McCartney. And George Harrison says, yeah, Monday, yeah, Beetlehead.
Beetlehead.
So I used to call him Mondayhead because he was upset. I'm only obsessive. I mean, when we first started, we used to rehearse once a week, and I kind of saw it as a hobby. And for the first few years, because I was younger than him, I never took it serious. And there was one night, I didn't even bother going to rehearse because I thought, I'm not going, I was going down to the pub. And he literally kidnapped me on the street. I was walking down the street. It's just for a rehearsal. I was halfway down to the pub, and he literally pulled up in his car and dragged me in the car, said, you've got rehearsals. You know what I mean? So he was upset. But yeah, he did all the cassettes, he did all the posts, he did everything. It was his band. And I think that's when the fame thing happened and it all turned to Sean, and he lost that kind of... Power's the wrong word, because it wasn't a power thing with him. Power's the wrong word, but that kind of being in charge and being in control. And he was also very, very good at not doing anything cheesy or corny. He's a good teacher for that. And I've learned a lot since that about, you know, never ending songs with you know, and all that. And all it, and, you know what I mean? And fitting certain ways and never doing all that. And all these kind of, you know, cliche endings that musicians do. All bands do them still. Even the coolest bands do them. So, you know, he was, and once they kind of, and also not really getting the credit for driving us to that point, which he did, you know, and the music. You know, and other people getting credit for stuff he'd done and telling his story. And I think that hit him a lot harder. I mean, it really pissed me off, but I kind of just accepted it and kind of gone with it. Well, I kind of didn't, but it hurt him 10 times more than it hurt me.
Yeah. Do you feel like Sean never really gave him credit for his
music? Yeah, Sean never gave me credit. No, I don't think so, no. No, he didn't. No. Well, I've never heard it. I mean, maybe he might have done on the quiet, but I've never heard him in the press give anyone credit, no.
Yeah. Do you find it hard to believe that they're actually brothers, given that they're so different?
No, they are different, but they're also very similar. It's like me and Paul are very, very different, but really similar. I mean, you know, literally, I know that this sounds really cheesy and cliche, but we could almost read each other's minds. We'd finish each other's sentences, and I'd know what he was thinking. He'd know what I was thinking. He'd say things to each other, burst out laughing. So, I know that sounds. This sounds really cliche, and it sounds, you know, because he's gone now and all that. But he was like a brother to me. He was like an old. I didn't have an older brother, an older sister. So he was like an older brother to me. He really was.
Yeah.
And yes and no, but they're so different, so different, but similar in a lot of ways as well. But yeah, so different. They're very as you know, completely different experience, both of them.
Yeah.
I just really don't know. It's a shame, isn't it?
I actually asked Paul the question. This put shivers down my spine. I asked Paul the question. No, I said to him, how do you think Sean would feel if he got a phone call saying that you were dead? Can you believe I asked him that?
What did he say?
And he said, I don't know. I was like, no, go on, go there. How do you think he'd feel? And he said, I really can't say. I really don't know. And I said, well, how would you feel if you got a call saying he was dead? And he said, oh, I'd be sad. And I said, why? Well, because I'd lost my brother. And I said, well, what would that mean to you? And he said, well, it would mean that we hadn't made up. So it was just like, whoa. Very much the sentiment of him was that he was sad that they weren't friends. Like, there was still love there for his brother.
Despite
the fact that he absolutely disliked him and disliked his behaviour and the narcissistic side of things. But there was an emptiness and a sadness there. And it kind of ruined his life, I think. It really dominated his psyche for those years.
It definitely did. I remember lots of moments I used to say that to him. And I remember once recently, I don't know why this rings to mind, but we sat outside at Greg's at a service station in Staffordshire somewhere on the way to a gig. He was getting really stressed, and he was because of the Sean thing, and Sean had said something in the press and he got really upset and all that. And he was popping pills and smoking. He could see it was really bothering him. And I said to him, I said, I know it's not for me to say it, I'm easy to say, but you're giving if it's bothering you that much, you're giving him the power.
Yeah.
And you know, and I know it's he said, but you know what, we're younger brothers, as you know, they're always seeking like everyone does with the parents, whether they want to or not, subconsciously. They're always seeking approval of their older brother and the parents, even when we don't like our parents. Mm-hmm. Or you don't, you just always are. And I think there was always that. And it was really weird. It's because I remember using the analogy with when we lived in Australia. Australians really hated the English, but there was always that. They're always after the kind of... those after our Britain sees them, you know, like those after, like with bands, what does the British press think, even though they hate, you know? And it was kind of weird because he was always after Sean's approval. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And he wanted to be friends again. I could see that. Did Sean want to be friends again with him? I'm not sure. Honestly, I'm not sure.
No.
I just don't think, I don't know whether it is an age thing or that, but I just don't think Sean wanted the hassle or the... And I think that's an older brother thing as well. You get a lot of older brothers or younger brothers who just, younger brothers want to sort things out, the older ones just don't care, you know, not interested.
Yeah.
You know, so I don't know why, but I got the feeling that he didn't want to, but Paul did.
Can you remember when you were very first approached to play the drums in the band? Can you remember like the very first idea of it and who asked you and what happened?
It was Bev Lomax in my class at school, and her older sister was just getting married to Sean. And then Nigel Day came up to me, he was in another class, and said, oh, my brother Mark's in the band. And they both did the rehearsal at the same place. I didn't think they were the same band because, you know, completely different people. Mm. That was the first time I got asked. And they both came to my house separately. And I thought, oh, Mark's band will be a heavy metal band. I don't want to get involved in all that. And then I remember when I turned up at the first rehearsal, I was still at school, and Mark was there. And I walked in and saw Sean and Paul, and Mark was there. I'm like, oh, it's the same band. And Paul was very, very quiet, very quiet. And Sean took me to Dallas for a drink after that talk and all that. But I was intrigued by Paul because Sean, I was a bit loud like Sean. Not, you know, and then he tried to get me drunk. I was like, I've got school in the morning. He was like, have a whiskey, you'll be all right. And Nana's put Coronation Street on tape and said, have a drink. I was like, I've got school. Anyway, I got off. And the next rehearsals, I was just gravitated towards Paul Horse, and we just hit off straight away. We fell in love straight away. We got on. I think we had... A handful of, I can't remember how many arguments we have over the years, maybe 2-3 arguments. That was after we split up. Yeah. And we both had, I was drinking too much and he was doing too much. I don't think we ever really, really, we never fell out, not properly. No. Not during the band times. After the band times, we did, and other people got involved and it got a bit silly, but no, never joined the band.
I mean,
never.
I think from what I witnessed with the two of you, the only time there was ever any conflict was when you were pissed off because he relapsed again. Remember the time, the Buffalo 66 years, which that's the one thing that we forgot to talk about was the whole Buffalo 66 thing. So maybe we should just fill in the gap. Right, that was something where he was, I think I just had Sonny and he was in and out of using, he was trying to stay clean, but he was falling off the wagon all of the time. And I think that completely spoiled the whole Buffalo 66 experience, didn't it?
Well, it was weird. We were in a rehearsal once. He stopped put, and I was suspicious. He was. You know, you can tell.
You and me used to have a shorthand. We just have to look at each guy. Look at him, nod, and we didn't even have to say a word. We both knew.
But he was obviously not doing a lot because he was keeping it borderline and his sunglasses on. And that was absolutely suspicious in itself.
Yeah.
And then one day he said, I'm going to go out and get something to eat in rehearsals. I said, okay. So it'll be about half an hour. And he went out in the car, but what he didn't know was the car park camera was in the rehearsal room and his car was right under the camera.
Oh, wow.
And he sat in the car.
And
we were just watching him.
Right.
And I was just like, and I remember, I wasn't even angry, but I was just, you know what it's like? It's different than anger, isn't it? It's just like a real kind of,
yeah.
First of all, you feel betrayed, then you realise that's just selfishness on your behalf. Well, not for me, not for you. You've got family, it's different. But for me, you know, as a friend. And then it was like, fucking hell, why, what to do? And then what do I do when he comes in? Do we approach him? And I mentioned it, and then he denied it. And I went, well, there's no point in in front of everybody.
Yeah.
And he denied it. And then he'd go over the top being over-denying it, which is another sign they used to do, didn't they?
Yeah, I used to clean the house. Yeah.
I think he said he'd just come back from one of the rehabs you'd pay for when he was in West Indies somewhere.
Oh, Antigua.
Yeah, and I remember thinking, well, if you're not going to, you know, and I was just like, I was thinking, this is, you know, when you're not an addict, you think it's going to be easy, and if you're going to go in rehab, they're going to come out and all is going to be dandy, and it's not, it's the root that's the problem. It's not the addiction, it's the root of the addiction, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it's kind of naive to think that. You know, it would be, but, and it was great because he came in the band and he just brought so much to it. It was brilliant. Yeah. You know, we did that in Brown Tour. It was brilliant. You know,
Oh, yeah, the Ian Brown tour. I'd forgotten about that. Yeah.
Yeah. And he was brilliant. And he got us that tour. Paul got us that tour because he's in touch with him.
Yeah. And then he did the Big Arm tour after that.
I remember seeing him at his first Big Arm gig at the Eagle in Salford. I walk upstairs into the stage and he was so nervous and he was fucking brilliant. And I'm not just saying that because he was brilliant. I thought that'd take some bottle to do that.
The Eagle in Salford?
The Eagle, that was the first. The King's Arms, not the Eagle, the King's Arms, sorry. In Salford upstairs. It's kind of town, really, in the middle of town. It was the first gig he did. It was an in-the-city thing, I think. And it's off there, just off Deansgate. You go down that hill.
Right.
It's just there, under the arches, near Victoria Bus Station. It's past the Salford, it's kind of centre town.
And that was a Big Arm gig, was it? I don't
know. It was the first gig he ever did as a singer. He was shaking like a leaf.
I know, yeah. He was good, though, wasn't he?
He was brilliant. Obviously, we stood with Pat, and we were like, I mean, you stood there. It's like you know, watching your kid at the nativity play. You're like, get the first words out, and he did, and it was brilliant. And the old gig was brilliant.
Yeah,
you know, and he did that kind of Terry Hall thing, which worked perfect for him.
He did. He sort of channeled Terry Hall and Bernard Sumner, I think.
Yeah, he did. But that worked perfect for him. It worked perfect for him.
Yeah, brilliant. Derek, he talks about your close relationship with Derek. And
is that the dark? Is that the dark stuff done?
I'm sure there'll be bits of dark. What else is there? I mean, the heroin addiction we've talked about. Like it's, we've talked about how destructive and disruptive it is, and how it led to him getting kicked out of Buffalo 66. It probably led to the demise of being in the Mondays for a long time.
Without a doubt.
I mean, he gave up the. When they got the Oasis, when the Oasis tour came up, which involved Australia, Sonny had just been born. When he left, and he left because he was worried he'd relapse because of Sean. But yes, I mean, he ended up relapsing anyway, didn't he? Yeah.
Well, even up to the last few gigs, approaching the venue, the gig, he'd always pop a pill and say, "What's that?" Says anxiety.
Yeah.
And you can see the dressing room, they come in and the tour manager say, "Sean's 5 minutes away," and you could see it physically. Yeah. You could see him not twitching, but you know, I could see it in him.
You mean in this lot of gigs, like recently?
Yes, up to the last gig,
I mean, he was technically clean and sober from street drugs, but he was on so many psychiatric meds and anti-anxiety meds.
I agree.
And he never learned to actually do well without it.
Only Donna did it. The last gig he did, the Mondays, I didn't do it. It was Isle of Wight. I couldn't get out of Canada, so I didn't do the last gig he did, which to me is an awful. But you know, I think every gig, even up to the last one I did with him, you could see within 5 minutes going on stage, I used to think he was nervous going on stage, and I don't think he was nervous going on stage. And you could see, you know, sometimes Sean would kidding, he'd say something, and you could see he was bothered if Sean was gonna say something about him.
Yeah.
I have the headphones in, so I can't hear what's going on. But I'd say to him afterwards, "What did he say?" And he'd go, "Oh, nothing." Or he said, this. And he'd shout, he'd say something back. He wouldn't. But yeah, he was always really, really nervous. And I always thought
Yeah. Okay. I suppose the other dark thing to talk about is like the last days, you've noticed that there was something wrong. Do you want to just talk about how...
He used to arrive at Linda's, and obviously I used to go around. He arrived about 3 days before he was rehearsing. 2 days, I think it was, his time. And he just looked like... he just sat still, and he kept saying, jaw's aching, I can't hear anything, I've got food in my ear. But he had panic in his face, you know, and he looked panicked, and he was scared. And he'd had it a couple of times before, but he looked scared. And he couldn't physically move. And I thought, is that a stroke? Or is he going to have a heart attack? Something. You could tell there was something more than just, you know, we did a COVID test and a COVID. He knew it was something else. It wasn't that. But obviously, I have no idea what it was. But he was just something. And then the next day, he wasn't any better. And then I sat with him all afternoon. And he said, "I've got to get to rehearsal." I said, "Listen, don't go to rehearsals today. You don't need to. Just stay here. And I'll come back and see you afterwards. Or if you can get there later, I think Amelia's going to take him to Deansgate to try and get his ears syringed on the way." And I said, "But don't stress if he was rehearsing cheap meal. Don't stress if you don't get there." But then he turned up at rehearsal and he sat him in the chair next to him and he put his bass around him. And he just sat there, his hand on his bass. And then he started to play and he couldn't play. And he just said, "I can't hear." And I remember sometimes people exaggerate, but I was talking to him went to the side and he wasn't acknowledging me at all. So he was completely deaf. He wasn't just lost. He was completely deaf. And then we just finished. We said, oh, we'll finish. We won't call it a day. And Paul, I said to him, take him home. He'll be fine. Just go home, you know, and rest. And on the way, I just said, right, I'll see you later. I don't know if he heard me. And I went. And I, it's funny, I got in the car, I drove off. I thought, and I didn't know anything was going to happen. I don't know, but I just thought, oh, he was feeling ill, really. He was feeling ill. I should give him a hug. And I didn't. I just said, see you. But I did that. I didn't. I thought, if I give him a hug, he'll think, why are you hugging me? You think there's something, you know what I mean? Because he knew me. So I thought, that's why I did it, but I still should have done it. And I thought, oh, and then I did just cross my mind. And then afterwards, all the things started coming up. He wasn't right the last few days. He was different than I've seen him in, as you have, in loads of different states and in loads of bits of illness. And this was different. He wasn't, he looked scared. He looked scared.
Yeah. What do you put it down to? What do you think happened? I mean, the cause of death being ischemic heart disease and diabetes, I was like, come on. You know, that I don't know. Well. I mean, I know it's been talked about before, but he did get a booster jab 3 weeks before and then flu. And that, I mean,
that was 3 weeks before.
3 weeks before, if it wasn't the day, Sean said it was the day before. It wasn't. It was 3 weeks.
I didn't know that, right? Yeah. I haven't had any of them because I don't trust them. So, you know, no. I haven't had a single shot. But would you have been shocked at any point if someone phoned up and said, Paul's had a heart attack? I mean, because I wouldn't, because he's never broke a sweat in his life, has he?
The symptoms that you were describing are not correlated with a heart attack, are they? There's some sort of clot, doesn't it?
There was no chest pain. There was no shortness of breath.
Uh-huh.
He kept saying his jaw here and his jaw is here, and there was pressure here, which would, like, I mean, that's the first thing you said. There was he had no problems breathing. There was none of that. No, no, no. That would,
even though he smoked like a troop.
When he was 18 and he joined the band, he didn't smoke, and we all smoked. And I said to him, why don't you smoke? Because everyone smoked. And he said, oh, all that backwards and forwards with the arm. It's going to be like too much hard work.
That's funny.
I can remember we sat in the Morning Star when he said it. I remember just looking at him going, oh, God, that's brilliant. Just, you know.
How did you handle it when you got the call? Like, were you shocked?
Yes and no. One, like I said, if anyone had called me anytime and said I had a heart attack or it, I wouldn't have been. And same with me, because we're both anxious and people with anxiety get, you know. But because of what happened the night before, and when the phone call went, it was Dan, and Dan never calls me. And I went, is it Paul? Oh, is it us? And he went, yeah, you better sit down. I went, oh, I know, you don't have to tell me. I know what it is. And it didn't, I kind of just started running around the house and moving around trying to do something. And I went for a walk and tried to kind of digest it all. It was just, I'm getting upset now. I just, you know, it's weird, isn't it, when people close to you like that die, when you understand it and take it in, but then you don't really, do you? You do and you don't. It's like, Vanessa said to me the other week, can't believe Paul's not here anymore. You know, Vanessa never saw him. She's only once a year or something, or once every 2 years. I can't believe. And she said, you know what? She went, he was always really nice to me. And she's really funny. And I said, that's the thing. That's what I was saying. The gig, people don't understand how funny he is. You know, because people, he's funny. Even Paul Davis, the two funniest people I've ever met in your life. The funniest man in the world. Really funny. And clever funny. You know, not silly funny. Clever funny.
Yeah.
And then Mark phoned, and Mark was absolutely beside himself. And I went, and when I got down to Linda's, he was just bawling his head out. And he said, and he had an argument with Sean and him, and he said, I just can't cope. I've got to go. And he said, but I don't want to leave him. And I've never seen Mark like that ever. And even the first gig we did in Scotland without Paul, and we're driving home, and Mark just leaned over to me and said, we're going to be home on time. And I went, I know. He went, it's not the same about stopping every 30 minutes for Paul to have a cig and you have a piss. So I have a piss every 30 minutes and Sean has a cig. And he said, and he just looked at me and Mrs. Mark, and tears rolling down his eyes. He just put his head on my shoulder and we both just started. And I know we're going all Hollywood, but we both just started tears through now. And he just really, and you know what? And Rowetta as well, she took it really bad. And she's been really good on stage. Every gig she's mentioned him, every gig.
Yeah. Must be really difficult doing gigs with him not being there. How do you manage?
You know, it's just weird because we had this thing of just like glancing and looking. And if I would do anything slightly fancy, I'd look over. I knew he was burning me out, burning the back of my head with his eyes. You know what I mean? I just go, And I knew we'd be like, oh, we both, any of us make a little mistake, we'd look at each other and be like, no one else would spot it. And it's just very, it's weird. I have what's called an ear, so you have one ear in when I've got all the sound and one out, so I have them both in now. And I just, it's really, 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 really strange. But I've still got my last message to him that he never replied to. There it is. Oh, I don't know if you can see that, but I'm just asking at the very end, the bottom one, how are you feeling?
Right.
Can you see that?
Yeah. Wow. Do you feel him around? Like, what's your belief? Do you feel like he's kind of got any kind of consciousness going on?
Well, it's hard, isn't it? But well, at one stage you do, if I'm doing anything. But you know what? Whenever anything I do, I was talking about this the other night, we do these gigs and these Q&As, and the guy starts by saying, you know, about Paul Ryder, and every night he gets a standing ovation. I'm not just saying that, honest, every night it's brilliant. The guy just says, before we start, so I had to start, you know, I was like, Paul Ryder, and I say, yeah, because he starts the backside of the band, and every night, and every gig when Rowetta said it, the old cheer.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, apparently he was in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame memorial section.
Yes, I see that. Someone sent him I know, all posthumously, all the things he would have wanted, he's got posthumously,
haven't he? Oh, my God. And the funeral, the star-studded funeral.
You know what? The irony in it, I know, that's what, you know what? That didn't go unnoticed by me. I knew you thought the same. It's funny because all these things, it's like, you know, I wish people fucking told him when he was alive.
I know.
Everything. I used to get, it's funny, after the gig, I said, oh, I sort of love that. You know, and he loved it. The same thing, you know, then he gets the recognition he deserves, and it's posthumous, and it is too fucking late.
Yeah.
You know, it's all people say, it's too late. Should have got it when he was alive.
Yeah.
But, you know, and every night we talk about it, even when I'm playing guitar or writing my own songs, every single time I do something, if there's anything slightly that might be slightly cheesy, he's there. Because he was my teacher when I was 15 when I joined the band. So he was a teacher when we started writing songs and doing music. And I'm not just saying this is honest, it's from the heart, this is true. Every single, whenever I'm creating anything, he's always there, making sure that I don't do anything cheesy.
Yeah.
Always has been, even when he was always the one you do something when you're writing songs, look at it, say, here you go, you know, oh, that's cheesy, I won't do that. You know, he just gives you that, you know, that look.
Yeah.
You're looking like. So in that way, yeah, his DNA lives on in everything I do.
Yeah.
But whether he's around consciously, I hope so.
Talk a little bit about the funeral, what you thought.
Well, just how we said, he would have loved to have been there. You know, sat in the seat at the back. No, not too, you wouldn't want to walk too far.
Yeah, he wouldn't have stayed long either, would he? He would have left.
He was heavy.
Oh, right, yeah.
His guitar's in there with him. What? Or his cigs.
Cigs.
You know what? I had a TK Maxx empty bag I was going to bring with me, put on the coffin for it, and I bottled it at the last minute. I thought someone might say, it's bad taste, that.
Me and Amelia were saying we're going to give everybody a goodie bag, a TK Maxx bag with a packet of Pall Mall, some sweets, and I can't remember what the other things were, like a little goodie bag for everyone at the funeral. Yeah.
Yeah, I struggled from start to finish, to be honest with you. And then at Bez's wedding, I struggled as well. I was sat to Amelia at Bez's wedding, I got really upset.
Did you? What, just because he wasn't there?
Yeah, well, Amelia sat next to me and said, I was just thinking, it's funny because I was just thinking, me and Vanessa was sat next to me, was there, I was there, and Amelia was there. And Vanessa said, Paul should be here, shouldn't he? And I went, yeah. And then literally 30 seconds later, Amelia said, my dad should be here. Literally within, probably about a minute or something. And I was like, wow, you know. And I got that kind of, got me a bit upset.
Yeah.
But the funeral struggled from start to finish. And even, you know what? I went back afterwards for a drink and I had one and I left. And I left because I didn't want to hear people, you know, when you go afterwards, you hear people saying how great they're, how great the friendship was, how great, who weren't, who he hated and they didn't like. There weren't many of them people there.
There was a handful, wasn't there?
A handful. And I knew, I won't be able to just, you know, I won't be able to say, oh yeah, I just have to say, yeah, but you fuck. And I didn't want any of the lip service and nonsense, and I just got to get away. And I justified it with myself by going, that's what Horst would have done. He'd have slipped off early, wouldn't he?
He would have gone home early. He would, yeah. He really you
know, would. So I justified that with myself. And it's like, it's funny because at gigs, we liked it quiet before and quiet afterwards. And we used to always, it's like now we do gigs, I'm the only one getting the van back to the hotel first on my own. It was always me and Alice, you know.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think about it every day. Like I say, I looked for my phone the day and met it. You know, anyway, you know, yeah. But yeah, what he does, he lives on.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I remember his drinking because he wasn't a massive drinker when we were younger. He'd have a drink and then, but as the time went on with the band, he started to drink more and more. As a band, when the fame hit the band, that's when he started drinking more, Paul. He was never a big, I mean, he'd drink, but because he always drove, he liked to drive everywhere. He didn't drink. He was always a designated driver. So he didn't drink. He used to drink shandy most of the time up until the band was successful. He used to drink shandy.
Really? Because he talks about going to the pub when he was 14 and going...
Maybe he did when he was out, because that was a kind of rite of passage. Maybe he did when he was 14, 15, 16. But when he passed his test, he drove, he didn't. He was on shandies because he was driving everywhere. Mm. He just went to the pub on them people and he had Steffi went out with for a long time, you know. He didn't. He wasn't a big drinker. But it's funny, I only noticed this when I was thinking about this recently, as the fame progressed, he drank more and more and more.
Right. Yeah,
and obviously, and got into coke at one point. Him and PD got into it quite badly.
Do you think that the fame caused the addiction, or do you think that the addiction would have happened anyway?
I think the addiction would have happened anyway. I don't think the fame had anything to do with it. I think quite the opposite, actually. I think the loss of control in the band with the fame contributed it to it, but not the fame. Not because I mean you could. You know, he's like me, he doesn't like the attention, but he wanted acknowledgement for what he'd done and what he achieved. And that, I think that pissed him off and maybe that contributed, but the actual fame and the thing, no, I don't think that did personally.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, he was pissed off that him and the band never got any credit for anything.
Yeah.
And he took that really personal.
And the fact that Sean wouldn't write an album with him. Like that he wanted, he told the story about when you and him went to meet McGee in Hollywood.
Yeah, in Hollywood, yeah.
And McGee said, oh yeah, Sean wants to write all the music.
And then we both, me and Paul both just said, well, it's not a Money's album, it's a Sean Ryan album. He said, yeah, but he reckons us it'll be a hit. And we went, but we're in the situation we are now because we did the music, we was a band, you know. And he said, well, Sean reckons it was the producers that wrote all the hits. And I went, well, have a look at the publishing. It's not. And it wasn't the producers. It was songs that were his before the publishers got involved. The producers got involved. And I just said, and McGee, and I think McGee still believes that.
Really?
He said it to us at a gig in Scotland, a festival somewhere, me and Paul was going on to him. He asked us again, and we said, no, we wrote the fucking songs. We wrote that, so, you know, you wrote for Lux and all that, people's favourite songs. And he said, yep, Sean said that it was the producers. He's adamant it was the producers wrote that song, not you lot. And we were like, I said to Miggy, I think he's pulling your leg. I don't think he's being serious. We went, no, I think he is. So I don't know whether he's being serious or not. I don't think
it's just that he wants to undo the importance of the musicians, I think.
It's very difficult with singers and musicians, especially when... There's always separation in bands with singers and musicians.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's always is.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they both don't get each other. And I think, you know, it causes lots of issues. it's a very different monster being a musician than being a frontman or being a front, you know, it's really different. So I don't know.
There's no logic though in cutting you out. Like if that has been the magic formula up to this point, then why change that? Why mess that up? Well, why cut you out?
I think he thinks that and I've said this, I think he thinks that maybe we'll be stuck in the past and just want to make tunes like we used to do, and he wants to do something more modern, more contemporary. And that's not the case. I want to do something more contemporary. I want to do something. You know, it's a tough one because you've got a fan base, so you've got to have some sort of link between the past, but you don't want to sound like the past.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you know what? It's difficult writing music with few people because you end up having to compromise. Mm. It's easy with our one or two writers because when it's three or four, yeah, you end up compromising, or you know, it's difficult. So I think if maybe thinks it's just going to be, it would be a lot easier.
Mm-hmm. So the writing process in the past was always that it was the musicians that wrote the music, and he would come in after the music was written and do the melodies and the lyrics. Like he had no involvement in the actual musicianship.
He had no involvement in the music, and we had no involvement in the lyrics. No, we used to start off with usually bass line or some keyboard. A lot of times with PD later on, but early on, it was bass line and then drums, and then Mark had always put some great guitar, and Sean would sit on the floor scribbling and singing. And then so we started with music. You know, I can never come in with lyrics, and then we tried to do it. You know, it was always the music first, and then that's just how we did it, yeah, back then. Yeah,
it's funny how he's got this mental block. It's odd, but just beggars belief, really. I don't understand.
No, I don't know. Bands are complicated, aren't they? Musicians are complicated. I don't know, you know, people, and also. People have their own ideas of what makes a band work, or you know, everyone thinks it's their part's the most important, or
yeah,
you know, everyone just that's just bands, and you know.
Do you think the tension between Sean and Paul actually helped and added to the magic of the Mondays? Do you think without that tension, there wouldn't have been the magic?
I don't think so. I don't think it did. I don't think it did. Maybe early on, but I don't think so. Because when we were writing, there wasn't a lot of tension, a lot of friction. Right. We didn't really, you know, we never really stepped on each other's toes, any of us. Mm. We were all very diplomatic when it came to writing music. So I don't think, I don't think so. Maybe between them in their own heads, but I didn't see anything like that, no.
Well, do you think the opposite is true, that if there hadn't been that sibling rivalry, that the Mondays would have had many more albums and been more productive and had more output?
Oh, that's a good question. There's a many number of things why we didn't. You know, we all blame each other, and we were all to blame, every one of us. Every one of us. Maybe. Both are good questions, actually. Maybe I'm completely off the mark with both. I didn't really notice it in the early days. I'm younger than them both, so I didn't really see it in the early days as much. It was only later on when I kind of saw that. And they were both very cautious not to show it in public. Part of the time when we were in the jungle in Panama, they started arguing. And then the argument ended up them both arguing who had the biggest belly.
Oh, you got to tell us about this. I don't know all this.
Oh, it's a brilliant story. So we go to this... in the Amazon. So we go down to the river and there's some guy interviewing from a local Panama Times, whatever. So he does an interview. He's writing photographs. Can you get your drumsticks and you get your guitar and stand in the river and have your photograph taken? And me and Horse went, no, it's not the Swinton Journal. You know, like them local newspapers when you do that. I'm not doing that.
I remember.
And Sean went into a rant saying, you know, you do what you're supposed to be done. You know, don't be doing getting all precious and all that. So then them two started arguing. We went out the river And then John was saying, this is how the TV works. And Paul said, oh, Angela was involved. She knows the producer, director, you know, blah, 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 blah. And the argument went on back and forth for ages. And one of them was stood in a canoe. Paul stood in a canoe, Sean was on the shoreline, and they were arguing. And then he said, well, you're just fat and lazy. You're fat and lazy. And then one got the belly out. So look at my belly. They both had the bellies out going, my belly's bigger than yours. Your belly's bigger. I've got diabetes. He said, I've got heart disease. You know, they're both fat. And everyone was just stunned and shot. And he got to the point before that, me and Bez were trying to split it up. And at that point, me and Bez just burst out laughing. And I remember me and Bez sat on the bank, just couldn't stop laughing. And what was brilliant was the guy who was the director of it all, and who set it all up, the interview, after it finished, the guy was our manager then. He was apologising to the director, went, oh, no, it's fine. I've got a brother and we're exactly the same.
Were they filming the argument? Did it end up on camera, the argument?
Yeah, but I don't think they've used it.
They didn't use it. Oh, that would have been the best bit.
Yeah, it would. Oh, it was so funny. Literally, they had the bellies out arguing. It was the biggest. Honestly, it was really. It was just. But they were angry at each other. And it was just so comic.
What was the point of trying to prove they had a bigger belly than the other one?
I think one that they weren't as mobile, so they were being like being so getting in the water was being like, you know, being really heroic.
Oh, that's hilarious.
It was, but Paul, you know, I was on Paul. He was right. I thought he was right. You know.
Yeah.
I mean, I got Sean's point as well. You know, you've got to do your president. But Paul's like, you know, in the water, it looks like we're in the.
No, you wouldn't have your bass guitar in the river, would you?
Well, it just looked like one of them young. And Paul's very conscious of how visually how we were seen, and that's what that was. Yeah. And you know what? That stood us in good stead from day one. So yeah. You know, he was right. But then again, Sean was saying, well, it's, you know, it's a newspaper in Panama, and who's going to see it? You know, and then Paul, well, so what does the matter then, does it? So then they just went, and he's like, but it was like a proper, like an old argument. And they used to have fights when they were younger. They used to stand toe to toe fighting, punching each other.
I remember one in Birmingham that broke out in the rehearsal room, and I was filming for something else at that point, and Rowetta marched me out with the camera. Were you there on that? You must have been when London Records came to see you when you were in the school.
Yeah.
And Bricks came through the window. Yeah. Can you tell me about that?
It was a girl I used to go out with. Who was always hanging out outside. I hadn't gone out with her. So I don't know whether it was her or not. We always thought it was her, but we have no proof it was her or her friends. We have no idea it could have been her. But it was in this old Methodist church school. And it was a safe area. It was a nice area. It wasn't a bad area or anything. And London Records Publishing came up to see us. No, London Records came up to see us. You're right, not the publishing came up. And they came in and they said, oh, what's it like? You know, they said, oh, we couldn't find Manchester. We couldn't find this. And they came in. We said, oh, the car's okay. We said, yeah, it's fine. It's safe around here. I don't think they'd even been up north. So yeah, it's completely safe up here. It's fine. It was a low crime area. It wasn't a bad area. And literally 10 minutes through the first song, the brick came through the window and they just all dived on the floor like it was under mortar attack. And because we were so nervous and wanted them to hear the song, we all carried on playing. So they thought this must be a regular occurrence. They didn't flinch when this happened, which wasn't the case. And then when it finished, Derek said something brilliant. When it finished, Derek broke the ice and went, we must be getting better. And he went, why? He went, last week it was two bricks. That's a real Derek one as well, isn't it?
Oh, super.
And then they left and that was it. Well, no, they said they wanted us to dress up like culture.
They said you didn't have an image.
Yeah, and Paul was really angry at that. I remember Garvey's like, he thought we were Mormons. Everyone thought we were Mormons. Wherever we went, people go, you, the Paul saw us, isn't it? When first I went to my side, this guy comes to his rastra and went, are you guys Mormons? Like, what is our haircuts and little beards and the clothes, the cords and all that? We've got it all the time, you guys Mormons. Honestly, we must have got it about three or four times in the early days. You guys Mormons? Yeah, all the time.
And it was a hairy boy look.
Yeah, but we'd gone on to the kind of goatee beard. And then he was like, and he said, the guy who was with him, from the London Records said, are you a Christian band? And we went, no. Why? He went, no, because the clothes, are you Mormons? And we went, no. Yeah. And then Sean said something like, he's what they dress like on football terraces. Gaz is a football hooligan, which of course I wasn't.
Right.
The football, but he just said, you know, to get the point across. And Derek said, football hooligan, Gaz. He has to run round in the shower to get wet. And then Paul said, yeah, if Gaz isn't a fighter, he couldn't put a cig out.
Brilliant.
I remember that really clearly. That
brilliant. Derek's influence at the beginning, can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, Derek did everything. If it wasn't for Derek, we wouldn't have done anything. He brought the PA in, you know. Obviously, he was a bass player. Paul listened to him a lot, but obviously, him, Derek and Sean, Sean did one. You don't want your dad around here when you're doing that. You know, you don't, you know. It must be, that's what I thought early on. It must be really difficult. You know, you're in a band, you have a bit of a wild time and so on and that, and your dad's driving the van and doing the sound and everything. You know, right. So it was difficult because we loved it, it was great, but it must have been really hard. It must have been really hard for Sean Paul. It must have been really hard for him.
Mm.
You know, I didn't really appreciate it at the time. You don't, as a kid, you don't think about it, do you?
Right, but he didn't really behave like a kind of a shielding parent, did he? He kind of, he was one of the lads, wasn't he, Derek?
Not early on. Early on, he kind of was when we, yeah, when we got a proper crew and he got on board with the crew, he was great, yeah, he was. But early on, mm-hmm. he had to, you know, he was one in charge of everything, had to keep us in control. But, you know, and we used to make fun of him sometimes and he used to just ignore us and get on with it. But if it wasn't for him, we wouldn't have left the rehearsal room. We always, and I said, luckily, before he died, the last time I seen him, I went around and I said to him, you know, I just said, thanks, you know, without you, we wouldn't have got anywhere. You know, glad, and the funny, because I said to Paul, I said, I went to see Derek last night, your dad. I never called him your dad, because he used to just laugh when we said that, yeah. Your dad. And I used to say, awesome last night. I just said, thanks for doing it. I said, oh, he'd appreciate it. I'm glad you did that. He said, I say it to him all the time.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, I know Paul, you know, Paul, well, dad, Derek were really, yeah, I know.
Have you got any good Derek story, any good Derek anecdotes from being on tour with him?
Got a great one about Barry. Did Derek and Barry? Derek and Barry. We did the Colourfield tour, and Barry Seddon, Derek's partner, was with us. And Barry was always saying he was in the Rolling Stones, and Derek goes, "Oh, he did it. Tour of the Stones." And Barry say, "I've done drugs all around the world with the Rolling Stones. I've done all that rock and roll. You can't show me anything." And he looked like a little skinny Dustin Hoffman, Barry, spit of him, but dead skinny. And he was kind of the stooge. He was like the Bobby Ball of their double act, you know what I mean? And we had to sleep in the van. We had no money for a hotel on a services in Leeds. And I woke up in the morning, looked behind me, and he was injecting himself. And I freaked out. And I was like, Barry was injecting himself. And I was like, all day, you know, we've all been taking a piss out of him. He really is. He's been like the rock and roller. He's still doing it now in his 40s. And all day I was really quiet. And I didn't know how to bring it up. And we did the sound check at the gig and went backstage before it was going on. And everyone was in the room. We'd had a beer. After a couple of beers, I loosened my tongue and I said, "Saw Barry injecting in the van this morning." And they all burst out laughing. So what are you all laughing at? And Paul went, "He's a diabetic, you dickhead." I didn't know that.
Oh, brilliant.
I think he was injected into his leg near his knee, if I remember. I can't remember, it's a long time ago.
Oh, God. That's a bit grim. Okay, so Paul tells a very, very funny story about when you played Wembley for the first time. Do you know what I'm talking about? And no. You grab him at the end, after you've come off stage, and you say, "We did it. I did it.
Oh, right. I played at Wembley.
Right. Do you know what the story is that he tells?
Oh, go on, tell me. Go on.
And he was thinking that you meant, played at Wembley. And you're like, "No, I wore women's knickers all the way through the gig."
Oh, no.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
I've forgotten all about that. Can't believe it. How do you remember that? I'd forgotten about that.
I mean, it's...
Keith Moon had done it once or something, so I had to do it. And I can't believe that's unbelievable. How do you remember things like that? I completely forgot that.
Would you forget that?
I've completely forgotten it. I remember it now.
Brilliant. So
I remember it now. I do remember it now, but I completely forgot about that.
Well, there you go.
But I remember because Keith Moon had done it. Bloody hell.
Oh, you did it because Keith Moon did it?
Keith Moon has allegedly done it, yeah.
Right, okay. Brilliant. All right. How did you feel when Paul left the band in 2000? So you just got this Oasis support tour. How did
I think it was Australia tour before Oasis. Yeah. It was Australian tour, wasn't it?
That's right, yeah.
I didn't want to do the tour. I don't think Bez wanted to do the tour, but I think we had to do the tour. I think it was all booked and sold.
Why didn't you want to do it?
Well, first of all, from a selfish point of view, panic. Because, you know, as a drummer and bass player, Paul, you know, we hooked in together and getting someone new to play, someone who we didn't know. We'd also, don't forget, Paul was like the older brother, so it was like a crutch that I kind of needed. I knew it wouldn't be as good. I knew it was also, it was the first time he'd never done a Mondays gig. He'd done every single gig till then. He'd never missed one. That's the first. So I knew, and you know how much it meant to him. You know as much as I do how much it meant to him. And I knew if he wasn't doing that, it was serious.
Mm-hmm.
So that was I think that as well. And it was fucking rubbish.
Was it?
Yeah, it was rubbish. Yeah, I don't even play bass. I don't even know who did it.
About the wilderness years?
The fake Mondays.
Yeah.
You know what? Kind of. That was a. I never really saw that as a Mondays. It was a weird thing because I was doing more DJing than gigs, and they did gigs without me as well, without telling me. They did a few gigs without telling me.
Oh, wow.
I didn't know. They didn't tell. One they did in Barcelona at the films, and I didn't even know they'd done the gig because I wouldn't. Because it was the guy who was the manager. It was his brother who was doing the film, and they all had. It was all, you know, anything I didn't agree with, they didn't tell me. So there were things where I was backwards and forwards to Australia. They were doing gigs and I wasn't involved in it. And they did this gig in Barcelona and put it out on DVD. I didn't know anything about it. And he even said on it at one point, I'm playing on it. I wasn't even there. I didn't know anything about it.
Wow.
It was a strange time. Doing a lot more DJing. And what I was doing, what was I doing? I was doing my football coaching and I wasn't really taking it that serious. I don't know what it was. I think I just did it for the money, to be honest with you. I mean, that was basically it.
Yeah.
I think it was just for the money.
Yeah.
It was very strange times. I don't got much recollection of it, but I've got a lot better. I bet we did a few gigs, though.
Hmm.
Went to Japan twice. Well, once.
What about when the band reformed again in like this last incarnation? That would have been 2012. Do you remember how that came about? I remember we found out about it by reading about it in The Sun. That was a tactic to announce it in the press that everybody was reforming again.
Yeah, same with me. I didn't know.
You found out about it that way as well.
Yeah, I was in Canada, so I was like, what? And then, and I'd seen these emails off someone. I didn't know who it was, so I never even opened them. Thought it must be someone I'm not even open, so I didn't open them. And then I missed a phone call, so I thought, oh, it may be. So I phoned him back, and he was like really angry at me. Oh, you phoned me now, are you? And I went, who are you? What are you? Who are you? What is it? And he got really angry. And I went, oh, fuck off. And I put the phone down. Then I got an email from him saying, I can't remember how it went. But yeah, it was all very, very strange. It was all, it wasn't a good feeling, to be honest with you. It wasn't. But I think me and Paul were optimistic that it was going to be a new start and go back to where we, when we first started, rather than that. But it just kind of just took off from where we left off.
Right. Yeah.
I think that to me, Paul was really supportive. I think that's when he went to his darkest times.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, with the band, you know, definitely because we both thought this was a new start, everything would be different, and it wasn't. In fact, it was probably the issues you had were probably worse, and it was still there. So it wasn't. So I mean, I think that was, and for me as well, it was like kind of it was like winning the lottery and then losing your ticket kind of thing, you know what I mean? It was like, oh, great, and it was great, and there was loads of interest, and he was playing big venues, you know, and then, but it was still the same. Like, it's like we hadn't even split up, and it was just the same issues there, and it was kind of a bit soul-destroying, really. I remember I was having bad anxiety after that because I was so disappointed in it, so I can imagine.
What was particularly disappointing you? Because on the surface, it looked like a massive success. You were doing
really well. No, it was. It was artistically, it was a massive success. But just like, I think being back as a close band again. The good thing was, the good thing that came out of it, me and Paul got back really close again, which was good. We'd have bits in the middle where we weren't friends and people had got involved and got, and we weren't, and that was sad. But literally, it was like starting again. Literally, in the first 5 minutes, we were best friends again. And that was really, really good. And we both said that to each other since. We both said that was the best thing about it.
Yeah.
And but yeah, the issues that were in the band hadn't changed. You know, so that was really disappointing.
What are you talking about there specifically? Just Sean's attitude towards everyone?
I think, well, yeah, not just that. I think everyone's attitude towards each other. I think, yeah, I think the dynamics in the band, to be, you know, to be very conservative about saying what I'm going to say. But yeah, I think the dynamics about in the band and kind of taken for granted, that kind of, and I'm not, there's this theory, not that we wanted acknowledgement to Steinman and all that, but if he could pacify us as much as he could, you know, that was it. It was really Sean's manager, not the band's manager. Mm-hmm. We had this opportunity where there was interest to get it started again. Oh, no. And we knew, and you knew, and that, I think that you knew, Paul knew, I knew, we all knew, and we were powerless to do anything. And that kind of, that makes you feel, something closes to us. What do you think? That makes you feel, you know, bad about yourself because you're not really, you know, it's a difficult situation. Yeah, and I think that, just because opportunity, we got back and we played really well because, but I tell you what was interesting, because when it was a proper band, it was so much different, so much better than the Fake Mondays. It was like a different, it was like a massive different monster. It was amazing. And everyone kind of thought, I think everyone thought it was going to be a bit of a process and a bit difficult. It wasn't. It came back straight away.
Yeah.
It was really, really good. And everyone was excited musically.
Are there any like quintessentially Paul anecdotes that you can think of off the top of your head? Just funny one-liners. What about the funeral when all his nicknames were read out?
Oh, he's the best at nicknames. Absolutely brilliant at nicknames. He was what? Oh, there's one. Right, there's one brilliant. So there's loads, as you know. But remember, I don't know why this one's just come to me. It just come to mind. I was about 17, and there was this journalist. A female journalist in Manchester, quite attractive, and Paul had got friends with her through a friend of hers, and he said he'd done an interview with her. He said, "Oh, she wants to interview you." So he said, "Oh, okay." So the friends got talking and said, "Oh, she fancies you. Will you go on a date with her?" So I said, "I'll go on a date with her if a friend comes and Paul comes as well." So we went in it was a pub across the road from Phil Sachs's, the Arndale. And the two girls were already sat there. And Paul sat with a friend. And I started talking, sat with this journalist on this date. And I thought, oh, she's quite attractive. Yeah, it'd be a good date. But I didn't know her real name. Paul called her Android. And I thought, why's he called that? And when she started talking, she talks a little bit like that. So I thought, oh, but only a little bit. So I thought, oh, that's because of Android. You know, that's why he calls it. And I thought, I had a little giggle to myself and all that. And I thought, that's fine. Anyway, so after a few drinks, she said, oh, I'm getting up to go to the toilet. And she got up and she went like this. I looked like a robot and my head just hit the table. I looked at him and I went, you bastard. And he went, I told you. Anyway, he had this other girlfriend from Boston called Paula, and he used to call her Olive Oil, which the song was after, but his other nickname for her was Peepers and Creepers, and he'd met her in town. He said, oh, we're going to meet her at town, come and meet her. And I was with a girlfriend at the time. I went to meet her, and she turned up, and I said, why'd you call her Peepers and Creepers? He said, you'll see. And she came in, and she had big feet and big eyes, and I was like, you bastard. You know? Peepers and Creepers, Olive Oil. And then it was funny, we had a... when he was going out with Alison, I met a girl from Liverpool when I was in Rhyl, and I was going to go down and see her for the weekend. And Paul went, oh, I'll drive, I'll take you down. I mean, I'll take you down and drop you off, and we'll drive back down Sunday and pick you up if you want anything. You know, she said, oh. I said, oh, really? He went, yeah, yeah, yeah. So we did, and we got to the house, and her and Alison knew each other. They'd been on a school trip, and the two schools had met in Wales 3 years earlier, and they knew each other. Wow. It was, how was that?
Wow, that's weird.
Isn't it? Isn't it?
Really weird. Wow.
Well, they both went, oh, Alison, oh, she's called Suzette and Alison, oh, and they went, you know each other? They went, yeah.
Oh, so bizarre.
How crazy is that?
Yeah, weird. Ugh.
Yeah.
Life's strange, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's not. Yeah. I think we've been given the wrong information about things generally.
You reckon? You think? Yeah. Yeah. Everything, yeah. And you know, that's the thing that was lovely about Paul and all that, because all my theories and my spiritual and all that kind of stuff, even though he never ever ridiculed me or ever, but he just let me go on about it and he'd smile or say something or have a joke about it. He never ever ridiculed, like others in the band would roll their eyes and go, you know, never did, never.
I think he's pretty open-minded on the spiritual sense. I really do. Like he was very open-minded, I think. That's why I think that it's very likely that he's around. Like, because I'm working on this podcast and I'm seeing him, I don't think he's dead, really, because I see him all the time. And it makes it feel like it's weird. It's really weird.
I know. But, you know, I know.
Yeah.
He's the only person that had a nickname that was a... And this is probably one of the greatest... We had loads of nicknames for each other, you know. We used to call him Alf Roberts and Snorbit and all that. We had loads of nicknames for him, but he had one... And loads of me, we had the best nicknames, and no one ever got offended. No matter how bad the nickname was, no one ever got insulted. We never got upset with each other. The nickname that me and PD had given him, and it wasn't even a word, it was a musical line. So, that, you know, and you probably know, so if he'd do something that was really arse, like me and PD would go ding, 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 ding. And even Paul was like, even at a gig, it was one of the first bass lines I ever caught for a song called. I think it was called Weekend Starts Here or something. It was one of the very first bass lines he ever came up with. And like, say you do something like the past year, and I'd look at him, he'd go, ding, 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 you know. Or like, we'd be walking down the street, and there'd be some like, you should always do it, real caricatures of Jason. There'd be like some overweight Greek bloke with a big dark beard, and beard walk towards me. I'd look at him, he'd go, ding, 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 ding. Or if there was like a skinny camp bloke with blonde grey hair, he'd go to me. His nickname was ding, ding, ding. His nickname was a bass line. How brilliant is that, isn't it? And I tried to explain this to people the night again. It's like, I can't articulate it, but his nickname was a bass line. Ding, 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 ding. And PD, PD, we don't see what used to do it to him.
It was nice to see PD at the funeral. He was...
Well, three of us were really close at one point, really, really close.
Yeah. Are you still in touch with him?
Not too much, but a little bit, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but it's the three of us are really, really, you know...
Yeah, well, you've gone through a lot together, haven't you? It's been
we just had a very similar sense of humour, you know, very similar, you know.
Yeah, yeah. All right, is there anything else that you... Anything you thought you wanted to say or... Any other funny things?
Just that it's the corniest cliche in the world, but you know, he's an older brother to me. He really was. He was like, I mean, really, honestly, really, really, really felt like that. I'm not being disingenuous. He really was.
Oh, is that Sandra? Hiya, Sandra.
Hiya, how are you doing?
Hey, are you coming to the do, Sandra?
Yeah, we're all hoping to get there. Okay, yes,
brilliant. Before. You're not going to be there, Gaz, are you?
No, my mum started drinking already for it.
Good. Are you going to be back?
No, I'll go back to camp, but I might not. But if your passport don't come through, I might
still be here. Well, then you'll be at the do. I've never had a problem with a birthday before, but now this one, it's too much. I'm just going to call it my 50th.
Right, I'm going to the pub. Yeah, okay. If you want to speak again, just let us know. We'll do another time.
All right. Yeah,
I've got loads of time in Canada.
All right, fantastic. Thank you so much.
I'd like to talk more about it because it's quite cathartic, that. I feel just got a shiver down my spine there. He's fucking here, isn't he?
Yeah, of course he is.
I've just got a really cold shivers. Oh, that's fucking weird.
Really?
Oh, it's boiling in here. Okay. Honestly, I've got all that. It's fucking weird. Oh, it's not going either. Oh, that's not going. Oh, that's very strange. Oh, fucking hell, yeah, that's going now. Oh, that's very weird. You know, you get cold shivers, they last for like 5 seconds.
Yeah.
Oh, that's very weird, that my heart's going now. That's fucking weird, that. That was very weird. Fucking hell, right, I'm going to go, I need a pint.
All right. Thanks, Gaz.
Don't speak again, please, Andrew. Don't speak again. Loads more anecdotes and things about it. I want to speak about him a bit more.
All right. The more the better. We've got 20 episodes. So there's hours and hours and hours of this, and like it's just going to all get released.
I want to talk more about him. There's loads of good things. I remember more now. I would definitely. Yeah.
Just start making little notes to remember some stories, because the funny bits are just great. Like, we need a bit of light relief.
Speak again soon. Take care.
Talk to you soon. Give my love to Vanessa and the boys.
Well, forget all to right. see you. See you later.
Take care. Later. Bye.
That's all we've got for you this week, but Gaz is going to be back in another couple of the bonus episodes coming up in the coming weeks. The song you're about to hear is by Gaz's project, which is called Yogi G and the Family Tree, and the song is called The Ballad of David Bowie. And guess who's playing bass? Yes, the one and only Paul Ryder. Do go to our website, which is paulryder.tv, and you'll find links to everything that you might be interested in there. Special thanks, obviously, goes to Gaz, who is just one of my favourite people in the world, and of course to the man himself, the late, great Paul Anthony Ryder. Lots of love to you all, and please come back to us same time next week. Bye.
Listening Productions.